All right, yeah, we were talking yesterday about the second fragment, the two paths. We haven't quite got through with that, so we'll see if we can finish it this morning. And we were saying yesterday that this second fragment on the two paths can be looked at in a variety of ways. On the one hand, it can be looked at as a sectarian argument, a bit of sectarian propaganda. And that interpretation, I think, is clearly there. And moreover, that interpretation, I think, influences all of the other ways of looking at this second fragment. Because throughout this fragment, very clearly, the author is arguing for one of these two paths, right? The author is doing his best to present them both equally, but he feels very strongly that one is better. And so he keeps arguing for that and putting down the other one. One thing which I would like to suggest is that, in fact, both paths are equally valid, all right? They really are. It's merely that here we have this sectarian impulse coming in, and that colors everything. All right, another way we mentioned yesterday of looking at the two paths, and indeed the primary one from the standpoint of this fragment, is that the two paths offer or are a choice of options at the end of that preparation which leads us through the mystic way, which we call the path, right? Offers us a choice of options. And a third way we mentioned yesterday is that perhaps the two paths represent actually stages on one path, things that everyone has to go through. And then a fourth thing we mentioned yesterday was the two paths represent two kinds of personalities, right, which we, using Pirsig's terminology, we refer to as classical understanding and romantic understanding. All right, today what I'd like to do is to go on and suggest a fifth way of looking at the two paths, and that is that they represent two aspects of each of us, so that all of us have got these two kinds of understanding in us. All of us are, in fact, walking both paths simultaneously. And to illustrate that, I want to talk about it in very physical terms. I want to talk a little bit about brain research. Because certainly man and his mind are by no means limited to the physical brain, but neither is the physical brain irrelevant to mind, right? Mind operates in our world, in us, through the physical brain. And some remarkable things have been done in recent times in studying the brain, which have implications for the voice of the silence, which connect with the voice of the silence. As long ago as 1836, doctors discovered that the brain consists actually of two halves, and that those two halves are asymmetrical. They don't do the same thing. Different sides of the brain are responsible for different kinds of actions. Now, in a sense, the brain is symmetrical, right? Because the left half of the brain controls all of the right side of the body. There's a crossover phenomenon, right? And the right half of the brain controls all of the left side of the body. In that sense, the brain is symmetrical. But it is also asymmetrical. For one thing, we know that most of us are right-handed. Right-handedness is dominant in human beings. And that's correlated with the fact that in most human beings, it is the left hemisphere, the left side of the brain, which is dominant. That's uniquely human, incidentally. Uniquely human. Animals will be handed, or pawed, whatever one wants to say about animals. A given animal will favor one paw, one wing, one whatever, more than the other. But if you take, for example, cats, approximately 50% of the cats favor the right paw, and approximately 50% favor the left paw. Whether a cat favors right or left seems to be an accidental fact. It's whatever the cat began using earliest and got into the habit of using. And because it is accidental, it turns out to be approximately 50-50. with the beasts. That's not true in human beings. Right-handedness, left-handedness is not something which is developed in response simply to external stimuli. It's an expression of something which we are born with, right? Which is inherent in the human organism. That's very interesting, that the human species is the only one we know which has a tendency towards specializing in handedness and hence in hemispheric dominance. Most of you probably know more or less about the specialization of the hemispheres. Let's see, how many of you are familiar in a general way with hemispheric dominance and what the hemispheres control? All right, good many of you. I won't spend too much time on this, but let me just say briefly, the left hemisphere is involved or controls analytical processes, analysis of all kinds, and particularly language, which is the most analytical tool of all. Right? Whereas the right hemisphere of the brain typically, now there are exceptions with individuals, but typically the right hemisphere of the brain controls spatial relationships, the perceptions of space, also music. The left hemisphere of the brain seems to process information in a linear fashion. The right hemisphere of the brain seems to process information holistically. Begin to see some similarities between the two kinds of understanding that we talked about and this thing that's in all of us, the two hemispheres of the brain. Some researchers in brain consciousness believe that there are, in fact, two independent streams of consciousness in all of us, one associated with the left hemisphere, one associated with the right hemisphere. For most of us, those two streams of consciousness are constantly correlated because the two hemispheres of the brain are connected by some tissue in the middle. And consequently, impulses can go back and forth and inform either side of the brain what's going on in the other. But there's a phenomenon known as the split brain patient. That is to say, there are persons in whom those connecting tissues have been severed by surgery. Now, initially this was done as a cure for epilepsy. Certain forms of epilepsy, it was thought, could be controlled by severing those connecting tissues. That interrupted the random sparking of the electrical impulses, which causes an epileptic seizure. So they began doing this with epileptic patients, and then they thought, well, you know, as long as we've got these nice people with their brains cut in half, we might as well see what the consequences are. So they began studying their behavior in various ways. And they incidentally, the person, the split brain patient, functions perfectly normally. You couldn't tell, right? Quite normally. Mm-hmm. Because both halves of the brain are getting the same information, since we have two eyes, two ears, and so on. They began studying the split brain patients in terms of their perception. And they discovered a number of interesting facts. One being that, the sort of thing I just mentioned, the right brain responds to visual images, whereas the left brain responds to language, auditory cues, linguistic cues. And if, in fact, you give a split brain patient two different clues, a visual one only to on the left side of the body, which will go to the right brain, and an auditory one that will go to the left brain, and then you ask the split brain patient to identify what he experienced. If he responds in language, he will respond in terms of what came through to the left brain. If he responds by pointing to pictures, he'll respond what came through to the right side. So there seems, in fact, to be two different streams of consciousness going on inside all of us. The right brain seems to process all emotional information. For example, one of the tests used was to show a young woman a mildly improper picture. They showed it, however, only to the right side of the brain. She blushed. but she couldn't tell why she was blushing, because the information hadn't reached the left side of the brain, where she could formulate it as language. So she had the emotional response, but not the conscious analysis of what caused that response. These different functions of the hemispheres, then, explain a number of things. Remember the other day we were talking about the behavior of teenagers who can sit and listen to a radio or a phonograph and do the homework at the same time? That's why they can do it. Music is picked up by the right brain, all of those logical functions by the left brain, so that the two sides of the brain are processing the two different sources of information. Notice what you cannot do is to study, to do homework, and carry on a conversation on the telephone at the same time. That can't be done, because that requires the same side of the brain for both. But the music, yes. Incidentally, the only animal who's been discovered, so far as I know, that has the same kind or a similar kind of hemispheric asymmetry as human beings are songbirds. And the songbird processes or stores or produces the song with the left hemisphere, which means that the song of the songbird is in some way like human language, in that it's a logical process for the bird. One thing which is interesting about this brain research is the difference between the sexes with respect to it. Normally, we tend to think of men and women as differing with respect to these two lifestyles, these two kind of modes of understanding we were talking about yesterday. How? We mentioned that we put them into that list, remember? Which goes with classical understanding, and hence with logic, and which goes with the romantic understanding. That's the way we tend to think of them, right? And that's the way, that's the alignment we tend to get. But in brain research, which sex has the stronger powers of left, the stronger left brain powers? Women. All right? Women learn language earlier than men do. All right? That's what left brain is. And in the case of a brain injury, a stroke, or any kind of other brain injury, women recover the use of language much more rapidly than men do. It's language inhibition in men is more severe in the case of left brain injury. Men, on the other hand, have the stronger spatial abilities that are associated with right brain. So that, in a sense, women are the logical sex. Right? And men are the romantic sex. Incidentally, I think that's true. I think our usual association is quite wrong. For practicality, for thinking about the logical consequences of any action, I'll go with a woman's advice every time. Men tend to be the dreamers, the unrealistic sex, borne out by brain research, so it must be true. Most of the research which has been done suggests that this matter of hemispheric dominance is not something acquired, it is inherent from the time of birth or even before birth, right? So it's something we are born with. What are the associations with these two sides of the brain? Well, the left hemisphere, as we have said, is verbal, the right brain is spatial and visual, the left brain is sequential, temporal, digital. It takes things in discrete units, whereas the right side of the brain is simultaneous, analogical, holistic. The left side of the brain is logical and analytic. The right side is synthetic and deals in gestalts, in wholes. The right side tends to be deductive. The left side tends to be imaginative. The right is discrete units. The left is continuities. The right is abstractions. The left is concrete. The right is realistic. The left is impulsive. Right? all of those kinds of differences, very similar to the ones we were talking about yesterday, can be seen inside every single one of us. So we are, as it were, asymmetrical inside ourselves, but we've got both capabilities. And one of the encouraging things is that if there is a case of brain injury, it is possible for either hemisphere of the brain to take over the functions of the other. Now, it's not easy, right? Maybe a struggle, but it is possible for that to happen. So consequently, we have in us the capability then of both of these paths, right? Of both of these lifestyles, of both of these options, and we can develop them. Okay, let me pause and see. This information which I've been giving you about brain research, I have not peered into brains myself, right? This comes from a very interesting book, which if you're interested in the subject, I recommend to you very highly. It's called Left Brain, Right Brain. It's by Sally Springer, S-P-R-I-N-G-E-R. S-P-R-I-N-G-E-R. Sally Springer. And it is simply a summary. It was published just in 1981, so it's relatively recent. It's a summary of all the work that's been done on brain research up to that time. And a very interesting book indeed, with, as I said, implications for the kind of view of things we see in the Voice of the Silence, I do believe. All right, let's go back to that list. If you've got it with you, fine. If not, I'll just mention some things in it.
I have a question. Is humanity now is more right-handed than
yes. Yeah, that's very interesting. There is evidence. It's not very strong. It's not very clear, right? So it may be wrong. But the evidence we have got suggests that the human being developed handedness, a preference for one hand over the other, and specifically for the right hand. And hence, one assumes hemispheric dominance, right? That the human being developed these things only about 50,000 years ago, which in, you know, the terms of human evolution is just yesterday. Right? That evidence has to do with artifacts, tools, weapons found. About 50,000 years ago, it looks as though the tools are right-handed tools. And for example, stones that have been chipped to be used for scraping or for cutting have been chipped in a way which suggests they were intended to be held in the right hand. And that phenomenon of the stones first appears about 50,000 years ago. So it looks as though this is, in terms of evolutionary development, a relatively recent phenomenon. Sure, right. Yeah. Oh, yes. Of human beings, got a statistic here for you. Let me find it. No, I don't have a statistic on the number who are right-handed and left-handed. I thought I did. But this is interesting, I think. Of right-handed persons, over 95% have language located in the left hemisphere. Notice not all do. There's a small minority who are right-handed and yet have language in the right brain. Of left-handed persons, about 70% have language in the left hemisphere, even though they're left-handed. So 5% of right-handers have language in the right brain, but 70% of left-handers have language in the left brain, which indicates that that brain localization of language is a much stronger force than handedness. They're connected, but they aren't. It's not a one-to-one relationship. Every person is born with a tendency to be right-handed or left-handed. Every person is born with a tendency to have language located in one hemisphere or the other. Left hemisphere is dominantly linguistic, just as, to a lesser extent, we are, in terms of manipulation, dominantly right-handed.
What about the ambidextrous?
Yeah. Well, I suppose that's the ideal, isn't it? To be ambidextrous. To be ambidextrous or to be ambicranial. Okay, good. Anything else? Yes.
You mentioned in the story of the young woman who was shown a picture of Zeresh.
Yes.
You said it was shown to the right side.
Yes.
I'm interested to know how they managed to show it to the right
side. Not
what
right.
Did they do? Deaden the...
No. There are several techniques for giving stimuli only, particularly visual stimuli, which are the easiest to give, only to one side or the other. One way, of course, is simply to put on a kind of blinder down the center so that you block out the vision to one side.
Can you see with the right eye then?
Yes. You see with one... Oh, the eyes cross over too. That is to say, all of the stimuli coming in to the left eye go to the right brain. And all the stimuli coming into the left eye go to the left brain. The optical nerves cross. See, they're just perfect matching. One half of the brain goes to the opposite side of the body, both for motor activities and for sensory impressions. So that's the simplest way to do it, is actually to block out. They have other devices which are used, which are somewhat more sophisticated. And these are that they present the visual stimuli not in the center of the visual field, but in the periphery. All right? The right periphery or the left periphery, and they present them very quickly. So quickly that you can pick them up with one eye or the other, but not the opposite one.
Even just an eye patch?
Or an eye patch, sure. A blockage. There are various techniques which are used for different purposes. They found different techniques useful for different purposes. I don't know of any work that's ever been done along this line. I'm sure some must have been, but I simply don't know of any that's been done with psychologically disturbed persons. I would assume that some has been done, but Ms. Springer in her book did not report it. So at least I don't recall that she reported anything about it, so I simply don't know. But the interesting thing, for me, one of the most interesting things about all of brain research is that although it is possible to localize language in the brain, there's a specific portion of the brain where language seems to operate. If that portion of the brain is injured for some reason, so that it can no longer produce language, other portions of the brain can take it over. So the brain is not specialized in the sense that there is one part which can be used only for one thing. It's a very adaptable organism, as indeed it would have to be. Right? And in fact, this is one of the things which suggests strongly that consciousness cannot be limited to the brain. Now, I think brain researchers have not drawn this conclusion, but it seems to me to be the inescapable one. Right? The fact that our thinking process can take place, can operate through various parts of the brain, and can move if one part of the brain is injured to another part, suggests that consciousness and thinking process cannot be purely a physiological one. That the physiological process is the tool through which it operates in the world. And if the tool is injured, then the process stops until it can get out, find another tool.
I'm not. Science 83.
Really? No, I'm not. I'm not familiar with that. I haven't seen that. Maybe. I don't know, so I can't say. I'm a little surprised in one way. It is true that there are languages which use pitch, which we think of as being music, right?
Yeah, the formation of the words.
In part of the words, that's right. It's part of the normal formation of the word. Now, all languages use pitch in the sentences, so that this is a statement, this is a statement, right? That's a pitch difference, which we use to indicate the difference between saying something and asking something. All languages use pitch, musical variation in that way. But some languages use it even more in the words themselves. This, of course, is characteristic of Chinese. Do we have any speakers of Chinese in the crowd? Do we have a speaker of any tone language? Japanese, which uses some tones. Okay. I can fake it then, and you won't know the difference. In a tone language such as Chinese, ma will mean mother, and ma will mean good, and ma will mean rain. I'm making these up, right? But the same consonant vowel combination pronounced with different intonations, different pitches, will mean quite different things. That kind of pitch, however, seems to be, so far as I'm familiar with this matter, seems to be quite different from pitch used in music. That kind of pitch, which is part of language, is generally a left brain activity, whereas musical pitch is right brain. And that might seem odd, but it's a fact. You may have noticed a person who is severely afflicted with stuttering, the cause of which, incidentally, is not known. Nobody knows what causes stuttering. But a person who's severely afflicted with stuttering, who cannot speak without the repetitions that are characteristic of stuttering, and incidentally, all of us stutter. Everybody stutters to some extent. It's only when it gets to be inhibitory, when it interferes with communication, it becomes a problem. A person who stutters with normal speaking can sing and have no trouble at all. In fact, what's his name? Do you know that there's a...
Mel Tillis.
Mel Tillis, that's right. You hear him talk, and he has very, very badly broken speech because of the stuttering. But singing is no problem at all, because there the musical basis takes over. So I've not heard about this. It's very interesting. I'd like to know about that. I don't know.
Is Ms. Springer speaking about lobotomy?
No, I'm sorry. Not about lobotomy at all. Lobotomy is when a portion of the brain is removed for certain particular purposes, and that does influence behavior.
Lobotomy is simply cutting part of the brain off from the other.
All right, now what split brain patients simply have the tissues that connect the two halves severed. That particular kind of cutting, and that does not influence normal behavior. A person who has had split brain surgery, you cannot tell from normal behavior that they've had any kind of surgery at all, because they're still getting all of the same impulses, the same impressions, they're still processing them, and they're still responding. Each half of the brain functions independently, but gets the same information. Yeah, right. Sure. If there are other physical impairments, then they're right. But the splitting itself doesn't affect behavior. Okay. Anything else? All right. Let's look just for a moment at this this list of descriptions of the two paths from this fragment in The Voice of the Silence. I just want to comment on one or two things in the list. notice that the one path is head learning, the doctrine or dharma of the eye, the other heart wisdom, the doctrine or dharma of the heart. And here, very clearly, we've got a connection with that classical understanding and romantic understanding that we were talking about yesterday. The two paths do refer to those things. The first path is called exoteric, and the second one, esoteric. And why should that be? Well, I think the first path is exoteric in the sense that it is public, as science is public. And the first path is one to be associated with scientific thinking. And what's the essence of scientific thought or scientific argument? If a scientist advances an idea, an explanation, what quality, what characteristic must that explanation have in order to be considered possible science? Logic, yes. Repeatable. You must be, somebody else must be able to do it. It must be testable by experiment, and it must be an experiment that anyone qualified can do and get the same results. All right? It is exoteric or public in that sense. Whereas, what is the characteristic of art? It's unique, isn't it? The artistic experience is something which is private. It's esoteric, right? It's personal. And two different persons can have quite different reactions to the same work of art, and yet both reactions be completely valid ones. Exactly, good example. Roger suggests you go into an art class and watch two different students painting the same object. And what you'll see is two quite different paintings. Right? Art is esoteric, private, whereas science is exoteric, public. And I think that's what exoteric and esoteric refer to here, as much as they refer to the notion that we have some kind of secret doctrine in the sense of something which we're keeping away from people. Right? That's not it at all, right? Okay. It's just something which is interior, and hence is necessarily, inescapably esoteric. A little further down on the list, just below the blank line on the left, we have a number of descriptions of the first path, the Samtan of I doctrine, fourfold jhana, the rugged path of fourfold jhana, the jhana path, haven of the yogi, contrasted with the six paramitas, the paramita heights, the arhata path. Where in the voice of the silence do we learn about the fourfold jhana? Which fragment talks about the fourfold jhana? Which talks about the four halls, or the three halls in the veil of bliss? The first fragment, doesn't it? The first fragment is concerned with meditation. Right, we said the process of meditation, and it considers that process especially in terms of this metaphor of the four stages. Which fragment talks about the seven paramitas and the paramita path? The third fragment, right? In a sense, then, the first fragment is about meditation, described as a fourfold process. The third fragment, which we're going to start talking about later this morning, I promise, regards the spiritual life not as a fourfold process of meditation, but as something which is sevenfold. So in a way, the two paths which are being spoken of are described in the first and third fragments. All right? And this fragment we are looking at is the middle one, which talks about both of them and compares them. Almost it would be better to do the first fragment, the third fragment, and then the second fragment, right? Because it's the comparison of the two. Now, what is the difference between the first fragment and the third fragment and what they're talking about? Well, let me suggest one possible difference. The first fragment is concerned, as we have said, with meditation and with training by meditation. in training, in meditation and in meditative training, what are you training? What's it directed towards? The mind. Right? Meditation. What does Patanjali in the first shloka of the sutras say about yoga? Which means? All right. It is the quieting, the controlling of those modifications of the mind, right? That's what meditation is. It's concerned with the mind. Which of the two paths is concerned with the mind? The first path is the mental path. When we get to the third fragment, we will see that the seven paramitas correspond with the seven principles of the human being. So in developing the seven paramitas, what is one developing? Not just the mind, but the whole person. Okay? All. Mind included, but intuition, emotions, physical. The whole thing. So whereas the first fragment is concerned with developing and controlling one part of us, just the mind, the third fragment is concerned with the development of the total human being. Right? And that's the difference between the two paths. That's one of the differences between the two paths. One path is mental control, and the other path is total control. Maybe you can see why the author really prefers the second path, right? In this way, and talks it up. A little further down, the first column, the first path, talks about to renounce all pity, whereas the second path talks about to love all beings. This is a characteristic particularly of this fragment which has sometimes bothered theosophists. The first path is described as the selfish path, whereas the second path is described as the altruistic path. Of course, that's another reason for preferring the second path, right? Who wants to be selfish? That's naughty, right? Okay, I think, and so much of that bother, did that bother theosophists that Dr. Besant, when she prepared an edition of The Voice after HPB's death, made one little omission from one point, where really it talks about the Dharmakaya Buddha as being the selfish Buddha. Besant said quite accurately, that ain't possible, right? The Pratyeka Buddha is a selfish Buddha. No Buddhas can be selfish. But I think we have to understand what selfish means here. And I think it means the kind of thing we were talking about yesterday. Remember Walpole, that sentence from Walpole I quoted, that the world is a comedy to those that think, a tragedy to those that feel. If you think, first path. Emphasis on the mind. As we said yesterday, you distance yourself from the thing you observe, and hence you can look on it without personal involvement and see it as a comedy. If you are involved emotionally with the thing you witness, then you sympathize, and it is for you, you participate in the suffering that goes on in the world. So I think that's what it means when it says that the first path renounces all pity. I don't think this is a case of the Pratyeka Buddha or anybody on the first path saying, I just don't care about other people. I'm not going to pity them. Right? That isn't what's involved at all. Rather, it's a case of a distancing. And as soon as one becomes distant, then there is we can put it positively rather than negatively. The distancing involves an assurance that all shall be well. That everything is going to work out finally to a good. And because of that that assurance, the tragic sense disappears. What otherwise is painful and awful and arouses our fear and pity, now we see as part of a great design. And so the result is the joyous laughter, which can be described as a lack of pity or a renunciation of pity. So let me suggest that if we look at it that way, then that first path ceases to be the selfish and heartless thing. Otherwise, it might appear to be in this metaphor.
I was thinking that might be interpreted as renouncing self-pity rather than pity for all. Renouncing pity for one, being sorry for oneself.
Yeah, that's a way to look at it too, which may be helpful.
Could this be compared with the impersonal compassion of the devas that is often mentioned?
Might well be, with the emphasis on the impersonal, and hence not the involvement. Still compassion, but compassion of a different kind, which seems to be distant and removed.
Sure. Yeah, and you can help much more if you're not emotionally involved.
Sure. In fact, almost to really be effective, you almost have to have that emotional distance,
you
don't you?
Arrive at an accident and get involved with the feeling of the person and how terrible this is. You're not going to be of much help. You have to be able to stand back and look at it and do the right thing.
Pity seems to be connected with superiority, so that in a way it's selfish. Perhaps love would be more equal.
Okay. Good. That's a good pity can be viewed as a manifestation of superiority. Right. So then, perhaps some other way of looking at it, such as love, would be a more effective one.
Even compassion.
Is it
compassion.
Significant that when the person, the flash of a higher consciousness or samadhi, whatever you call it, the minute you get out of the physical brain, that everything. That all the darkness and the fear and the ugliness disappears. It seems to be just this one part of us that.
Right. And that disappearance of the darkness and the pain and the fear is in fact correlated with that distancing, right, from the situation. So one can look at these two paths in more than one way. And what seems to be condemnation, in fact, then turns out to be simply a virtue.
A lesson to learn.
Right. Okay, and finally, just one other comment I'm going to make on this long list, because we don't have time to go through all of these characteristics. So one final comment, very near the bottom of the list. Those who follow the first path eventually become Pracheka Buddhas, whereas those who follow the second path eventually become Bodhisattvas. Leadbeater points out, and others have too, that the Pracheka Buddha is on the first ray, whereas the Bodhisattva is on the second ray. So in talking about the paths, we're really talking about a difference in rays. That's another way of looking at what's going on in this fragment. All right, I'm talking about this comedy to those who think and tragedy to those who feel. Virginia brought me a poem which she had mentioned yesterday. I'd like to share it with you. It seems to be based on this sentence from Walpole. The poem, I think it's a nice one because it suggests something that I feel is true too. The poem is entitled Common Lot. Life is a tragedy for those who feel, a comedy for those who think. Thus said a wise man. And it struck me as I read the words that he had closed as with a seal the volume of philosophy. The wheel to which we all are bound rolls straight ahead and knows no tears or laughter. We are led by our own temperament to woe or weal. And yet, how few have feeling without thought, and thought without emotion, fewer still. To the great number of us, life is naught but tragicomedy. We laugh our fill hysterically, laugh until we weep. Then, ere the tears cease flowing, fall on sleep.